right now on The Daily Debrief. A victim of child sex trafficking sentenced to life for killing a man who picked her up for sex is released from prison. And closing arguments in the Hollywood Ripper serial killer trial. Can the defense create any reasonable doubt? Plus, Eric Boyd, the man on trial for the brutal rape and murder of a college couple, his co-defendant takes the stand and says Boyd pulled the trigger. The Daily Debrief recaps the day in court. It's Wednesday, August 7th.
And good evening and welcome to the Daily Debrief. I'm Stacey Delicat in for Aaron Keller tonight. We start with the sex trafficking victim convicted of first-degree murder for killing a man who bought her for sex. Well, today she walked free from prison. Cyntoia Brown was sentenced to 51 years to life in 2004 for killing Johnny Allen. She said she acted in self-defense. Brown's case went viral. It attracted the support of high-profile celebrities like Kim Kardashian and Rihanna, who campaigned for her release on social media, while former Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam granted her clemency shortly before he left office in January. While in prison, Brown earned her GED and associate's degree. She has said she looks forward to working with other victims of sexual abuse. Not everyone applauded Brown's release, of course. The family of the victim released a statement today saying, in part, "We feel like the judicial system has failed again for victims everywhere. Our hearts are broken because we feel like Johnny never got to defend himself." I'm joined now by my guests in studio, criminal defense attorney and our own Law and Crime host, Linda Kenny Bodden, and New York Law School professor Kirk Burkhalter. Linda, let me start with you. Was this a good case for clemency? Did the governor do the right thing here when he said, let her out?
Absolutely. You know, there's been a whole thing in the law now that we should look at sentences after they're given, because in the height of the being emotional, maybe people change. Maybe we should give clemency. Maybe morals and morals of the society change. So, yes, I think he did a good thing.
I mean, also, this was a girl who was 16 years old at the time and tried as an adult. Kirk, do you agree with Linda? Was this a good case? Or, you know, you have the family and people who say, oh, this shows we're weak on crime.
Well, there are multiple victims here. The family, certainly they're victims of the crime, and the defendant herself was a victim of a crime. So as far as it being a good case, it's difficult to say. It's just that it's never a good case when there are multiple victims.
Yeah. I mean, is this, though, criminal justice reform working, so to speak, though? Here we have a woman who's reformed herself, by all accounts, has gone out of her way to change her life. She served her time. Now she gets, you know, she was in 15 years. Now she's out and perhaps can make a difference, as she says she hopes to.
In some respects, yes. But certainly, if you look at the family statement, they certainly felt as if she had the benefit of these celebrities and those with some money and power and so forth backing her. So if it's true criminal justice reform, is this how everyone is going to be treated? Or is it only those who have the backing of the Kardashians and so forth?
It's a good point. We'll have to see who the celebrities decide to give their attention to next. Well, we're going to move on now. Defense attorneys in a California courtroom trying to convince jurors to find the so-called Hollywood Ripper serial killer not guilty. Right now, the defense team is wrapping up closing arguments in what's been a months-long case. Michael Gargiulo is facing two murder charges in the stabbing deaths of Ashley Ellerin and Maria Bruno, and one attempted murder charge for allegedly stabbing Michelle Murphy. All of these occurred between 2001 and 2008. Gargiulo is also accused of killing an 18-year-old woman outside of Chicago, where he will stand trial after the California case concludes. Well, photographers in the courtroom caught Gargiulo appearing to smile and laugh with his attorney in open court. It's unclear at what point this occurred or what they may have been talking about, but as you can imagine, reaction to that has not been too good. Meantime, the prosecution emphasized the similarity between all of the victims and that Michael Gargiulo, he said, noticed all of them.
Similarity number one. That tells us the man who attacked these four women is the same man. The four victims in this case, it wasn't men, it wasn't children, it wasn't the elderly. It was four female victims, all young, attractive, and outgoing. Their characteristics are a common characteristic of the victims in this case. And don't forget, you have evidence that Michael Gargiulo was actually attracted and noticed these women. Michelle Murphy told you the man who drove the Gus the Plumber van would wave to her when she would see him. And as I told you a few moments ago, Mr. Gargiulo told his coworker that Michelle Murphy was hot and that he was going to get with her. Michael Gargiulo noticed Ashley Ellerin. He told his old friend, Mirko Hoffman, that the girl who got murdered in Hollywood was attractive. Anthony Castellani testified, every time Ashley Ellerin walked into the room, Gargiulo stopped talking to him, fixated on Ashley Ellerin, and followed her around the room with his eyes.
Well, prosecutors say the lack of physical evidence in this case against Gargiulo doesn't mean he's innocent. Far from it. They claim his killings follow a pattern with all the same hallmarks.
The attacker, the killer, took precautions to not leave evidence behind. The ability to plan and prepare and execute in stressful, fluid situations. Wearing booties, not leaving fingerprints. Evidence disposal, no murder weapon, or bloody articles of clothing ever recovered. Michael Gargiulo talked about this. He talked about this in this jail cell. He talked about knowing that you've got to be smart enough to get rid of the evidence. He talked about knowing what police officers and detectives will always be looking for. But the most damning piece of evidence are these two sentences he says in the middle of that transcript. When he looks at those undercover detectives and he asks them, hey, do they check the dumps? What about the dumps out of town? He told numerous people he studied forensics. You found out through the computer evidence and through things he said in that jail cell that he researched other serial killers. Maria Garola. Remember, he told Maria that he knew how to not leave fingerprints behind. And then, of course, telling Maria about being able to kill and get away with it.
Well, when it was the defense's turn to present their closing arguments, they made the jury really consider the meaning of the words reasonable doubt. Take a listen.
Let me ask you a question. As a juror, what is your objective in the trial of Michael Gargiulo? Think about it to yourself. What is your objective in this trial? Your objective, ladies and gentlemen, is to determine whether or not the state has proven guilt beyond a reasonable doubt and to an abiding certainty as to each charge that is before you. I told you early on when I spoke with you during the opening statement that I believe really the sole objective is to determine whether or not the state has proven that Michael Gargiulo committed the murder of Ashley Ellerin. Whether or not the state has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that Michael Gargiulo murdered Maria Bruno. Whether or not Michael Gargiulo attempted to murder Michelle Murphy. And so the issue of identity, the person that did these crimes that are charged, is based upon the evidence, as I mentioned.
Then the defense got to work picking apart the prosecution's case.
Yesterday, we heard the government's concluding argument by Mr. Garrett Dameron. And at the conclusion of his argument, I heard him say, the defense, the entire defense, rests upon Dr. Vian Castellano. He was telling you that our defense for Mr. Gargiulo, the entire defense rests upon Dr. Castellano. I get mixed up with these Italian names. Gets mixed up with rests upon the doctors. That's not true at all. That's not true at all. I mean, granted, there are aspects of all the doctors in this case, the mental health doctors, that do bear. And Mr. Rubin will talk to you about it, bear on what we call the elements of the crime. Every crime has an element. The crimes in this case have a mental state. In this case, as it relates to murder, specific intent, premeditation, and the alike. And Mr. Rubin, in utilizing the testimony of the three doctors, will be addressing those issues. Because every single element of a crime, every single element, if a crime has three elements, all three must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt and to an abiding certainty. I, as I mentioned to you, I'm going to be talking about the facts of this case. And I didn't hear a lot of facts spoken about yesterday as it relates to the murder of Ashley Ellerman, as it relates to the murder of Maria Bruno, as it relates to the attempted murder of Michelle Murphy. I'm going to share with you the facts that I have in mind, then ask you to decide whether or not the prosecution has met its burden. Look, you know, you've sat here for 5 months, approximately. And, you know, I'm not going to tell you what to do. You are the judges. And the only thing I'm trying to do is share with you, if I may, my thoughts.
All right, back to the panel right now. So let's talk about this for a second. Gargiulo was a good criminal. We heard the prosecution even say that, right? I mean, he did his homework. He bragged about how neat he was, making sure there was no evidence left behind. But Linda, how much is that lack of physical evidence going to hurt the prosecution ultimately?
I don't think it's going to hurt in this case. Now, initially, you were supposed to have, like, a fingerprint of a crime, other crimes. So if I looked at that, they could say, oh, yeah, look at that. You know, I wrote on the wall. I wrote my name. Linda Kenny Bodden was here, right? You don't have that here, but you do have him at all the locations, looking at all the women, making comments. I think his Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde personality came through quite good at this trial.
And let's talk about that infamous laugh that everyone's talking about, caught on camera. Here he is laughing in open courtroom, this horrendous murder trial. Does that hurt him? What do you think, if jurors saw that?
It's certainly not helpful. I mean, so you have this trial that has this name coined with it, Celebrity Ripper. And you have this, the prosecution painting him as this very calculated killer. And then to do this sarcastic laugh is just not helpful for the jury to see that. There are victims here, there are people that died. Just something you never want to see your client do, I think.
Certainly doesn't suggest remorse. A lot of people said this seemed like a slam dunk case for prosecutors from the beginning, but we heard some of the defense's case there. They're also pointing fingers at other men they say did the killings. Linda, is that going to be an effective enough tactic?
Not in this case. You know, I've been in that actual courtroom. That's where I tried Phil Spector case with Judge Fidler, who's on the stand right now. And there were issues in that case. We got a hung jury, obviously, the first one. But here, they really have him, as far as I'm concerned. I'm a defense attorney, and I'm telling you, I would vote guilty.
Do you agree, Kirk?
I have to agree. You just can't explain away all the evidence, all the coincidences.
Yeah. Well, we will see whether jurors agree. They should be getting the case shortly. Well, still ahead tonight on The Debrief, prosecutors are presenting their case in a grisly kidnapping, rape, and murder case of a Tennessee college couple. Three others have already been convicted of murder in the case, and now, years later, one of the convicted murderers comes forward pointing the finger at the defendant. Welcome back. Today, bombshell testimony as the prosecution's key witness took the stand in the trial of a Tennessee man accused of brutally murdering a college couple. Eric Boyd faces life in prison if convicted in the deaths of 21-year-old Shannon Christian and 23-year-old Christopher Newsom. The details of their deaths are gruesome. Both victims were allegedly beaten, raped, and murdered. Newsom was shot three times, then doused in gasoline and set on fire. Christian is believed to have been held captive for 24 hours, repeatedly sexually assaulted, then stuffed in a trash can and left to die, slowly suffocating. Boyd claims he wasn't anywhere near the home when the crime occurred. Four other co-defendants have already been convicted in the case, with sentences ranging from the death penalty to 35 years in prison. One co-defendant, George Thomas, took the stand today against Boyd in exchange for his two life sentences being reduced to 50 years. He could be the prosecution's star witness. Thomas was already convicted of first-degree murder in the case. In graphic testimony, Thomas pointed the finger at Boyd, saying he was the one to pull the trigger on victim Christopher Newsom.
What did you see Mr. Boyd do?
He got out of the SUV and opened the back door, grabbed Mr. Newsom, and they walked towards the drainage ditch area.
What are you doing?
I'm sitting beside the front seat, just looking.
What happens after that?
Then kind of pulled him off to the side. A stand of trees across I guess it was across the little drainage ditch. It was some trees over there, kind of pulled him over towards that way, well, walked him over that way. Then I seen three light, bright, you know, shots, basically.
Then Thomas described Boyd coming back to grab a canister of gasoline to light the victim's body on fire.
You said you saw the three flashes?
Correct.
Did you ever see a gun?
Well, I seen he had a gun, but I didn't see him with the gun in his hand as he was walking over towards that way.
When is the first time you saw Mr. Boyd with a gun?
Earlier, I seen him with a gun before that day, but I didn't see him with the gun in his hand that day when we was right there.
So when you saw the three flashes, who did you see pulling Mr. Newsom?
Mr. Boyd.
And where did he pull Mr. Newsom to?
Directly before me and to the back of the building.
What happened after he pulled Mr. Newsom to that location?
He came back and grabbed the can of gas.
Who did that?
Mr. Boyd.
So what happens after you see him get the gas?
He goes back towards the area where he had pulled Mr. Newsom, and that's when, a couple of minutes later, I seen a bright whoosh.
Earlier in the day, a police officer who questioned Boyd about a co-defendant, LaMarcus Davidson, then released Boyd only to arrest him 20 minutes later. Take a listen to what he had to say.
We were hoping he would be able to tell us something on the whereabouts of Mr. Davidson.
Did this point give you information about Mr. Davidson?
He was hesitant at first, but then finally he said that he wasn't going to jail for him, so he decided to tell us where he was at. He had told us that they broke into the house the night before, the morning before, around 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning, I guess. Once we had Mr. Davidson in custody, the investigators were up in Kentucky rounding up the other people. And at that time, they had called down and said, we need to go pick him back up.
Okay. Based on what?
Based on what the intelligence they got up there, we needed to go pick him back up.
So after you got that, well, let me ask you this. You know about how long that was after he was released that you got that information, if you remember?
After Mr. Davidson was in custody, probably 20 minutes, maybe.
Okay. So tell us about your reaction to that information.
Well, shocked that we just let him go, and we had to go find him. We were surprised that myself, my partner Jason Tarwater, and in his SUV and two Mark units went back to Ridgebrook. And as we pulled into Ridgebrook, he's walking down the sidewalk. So we got lucky.
Later in the day, we heard from a retired ATF agent who interviewed another co-defendant, Vanessa Coleman. Defense attorneys got the agent to admit that while this co-defendant did bring up Boyd's name, she didn't implicate him in a crime.
You were present when she was interviewed in Tennessee?
I did the interview in Tennessee.
Okay, so you actually interviewed her back here in Tennessee?
Yes, sir.
And again, I'm not going to ask you any, as far as hearsay or anything, but in her statement, she did not incriminate Mr. Boyd, did she?
She brought him up.
She brought him up, but didn't incriminate him as engaging in the crime?
No, sir. The statements she gave to me were consistent once she decided to tell me the truth.
And again, in all those five statements, she was not incriminating Mr. Boyd?
Well, sir, I don't know about the other ones that I...
The ones that you participated in?
The ones I participated in, she mentioned him but did not incriminate him.
Bringing in the panel one more time, let's start with George Thomas. He's supposed to be at least a star witness, one of the key witnesses for the prosecution. Kirk, let me start with you. Was he effective? What did you think of his performance on the stand?
I didn't think he was particularly effective. One thing that jumped out to me was the fact that he extricated himself from the scene of the crime and from all the criminal activity. So he was able to testify as to all these murders and seeing a gun and flashes of gasoline and so forth. However, at the end of his testimony, he stated that he was not complicit in the murders, and while he was convicted, he had no involvement. So you can't really have it both ways.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that raises some questions then about his credibility. Linda, if the jurors know he's testifying to get a significantly reduced right. sentence, how does that influence perception?
Well, you know, all of a sudden you have a reason or a motive to lie. I mean, if I think I can be out of jail at least the last 10 years of my life, I'm going to tell the cops what they want to hear. And he did not give any specifics. Kirk's right. I mean, he kind of removed himself. He didn't. He was like this old TV show, Hogan's Heroes with a sergeant. I see nothing. I know nothing. I did nothing. But I'm guilty.
There's been a lot of evidence so far. We know this was such a heinous crime. I mean, all of the details, hard to listen to over and over again. We know the co-defendants have been found guilty. So does that mean that this is just sort of a slam dunk for the prosecution? I mean, what do you think, Kirk? Or, you know, do we still have to consider a lot of the details here?
Oh, by no means. I don't think it's a slam dunk because you have to prove every element of the crime. And while the prosecution can probably place him at the scene, certainly have to show that he in some way caused the death. So was he there? What was the nature of his involvement? And I don't think this witness really helped today. So I think the prosecution still has a little bit of a ways to go.
Yeah. Do you think that they have, been effective thus far in their case?
I would have been embarrassed to put him on and give him this deal. I would have let him serve the time. And then maybe down the road, maybe if Boyd is guilty of something else, some other evidence would come out. But to put the family through this and sell them a bill of goods that we're going to get a conviction here, which they may, you never know, okay, but it's not certain, I think it is a tragedy, and the victims deserve more.
And what about the ATF agent who we heard talking about, the other co-defendant, Vanessa Coleman, who didn't implicate him either? So there we have another co-defendant who's not necessarily saying, oh, he was there, he did it. I mean, that chips away at their case a little bit, too, I would think.
Yes, it does. And we were kind of going back and forth on this earlier. I think you might want to put her back on the stand, try to get her under oath to testify that she did see him at the scene. Otherwise, that's somewhat, once again, damaging.
Let's just briefly talk about, you know, deals. We talk about George Thomas's
right.
deal. Not Boyd has gotten no deal. Obviously, there's no deal. But he did lead investigators to really the ringleader in all of this, right? LaMarcus Davidson. Should that count for anything? You know, does that mean he should get any kind of, I don't know, reduced sentence or any kind of leniency at this point?
No, not from here. He got 18 years. I think that he deserves 18 years. He did something wrong. And these poor people were killed. And he didn't really say anything about it.
Yeah. So. Well, listen, I want to thank you both, as always, for being with me. Linda Kenny Bodden, Kirk Burkhalter, thank you so much. And thank you, our viewers, for joining us tonight. Our live trial coverage resumes at 9 o'clock in the morning Eastern Time on the Law & Crime Network. The Debrief is live on Law & Crime at 5 o'clock Eastern. Have a great evening.